Well, welcome, my friends, to The Catholic Reason, a radio production of St. Michael Catholic Radio based in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, where we think through various claims made by the Catholic Church concerning issues of faith, morality, and culture, and provide reasons behind those claims. My name is Carlo Broussard. I'm a staff apologist and speaker for Catholic Answers and a member of the Chancery Evangelization Team at the Diocese of Tulsa in eastern Oklahoma. The Catholic Reason airs locally here in Tulsa every Thursday from 4 to 5 p.m. on St. Michael Catholic Radio 94.9 and 102.9. But you may be listening on your own local Catholic radio station at a different time, since The Catholic Reason is now aired on a few other Catholic stations throughout the country. So if you're listening outside of Tulsa, welcome and thanks for joining me. Just to note, you can download the show through whichever podcast platform you use by subscribing to the Eastern Oklahoma Catholic Podcast. And you can also access the archived episodes at carlobroussard.com under the audio tab. Last week on The Catholic Reason, we looked at four alternative theories to the Christian claim that Jesus bodily rose from the dead: the conspiracy theory, the hallucination theory, the vision theory, and last week we kind of lumped those two together, and fourthly, the apparent death theory. And we showed why those theories are unreasonable to assent to, in contrast to the Christian hypothesis that Jesus physically and gloriously rose from the dead. Now, in today's episode of The Catholic Reason, we're going to look at two more alternative theories, both of which basically claim that the Christian resurrection story is a ripoff or copycat story. These two theories are what is called the pagan myth theory and the Jewish origin theory, the idea being that the Christian resurrection story is either a ripoff from paganism or Judaism. Now, the Catholic claim that we're making in this episode is that the resurrection story is not a copycat story, whether from paganism or Judaism. And it's my intention to make good on this claim in today's episode. And so hopefully I can make good on that claim and that you'll agree with me. So let's start with the pagan theory. And the theory basically says that Jesus's resurrection is just one more instance of a dying and rising God, a motif that's prevalent in the religions of the ancient Near East. The Scottish social anthropologist James Fraser popularized this myth in his 1890 book, The Golden Bough, B-O-U-G-H, A Study in Comparative Religion. And the idea continued in modern skeptic circles, as the popular film Zeitgeist has shown. And skeptics like to parallel Jesus' resurrection with Egyptian and Greek deities. And we'll look at a few of these alleged parallels here in today's episode in one of our responses to this claim. Now, I've grouped our responses into two categories, just to give you a framework here. General problems with this claim, with this alternative theory, the pagan myth theory, and specific problems. So a variety of problems with this general idea of the Christian story of the resurrection of Jesus being a ripoff from paganism. General problems, specific problems. So let's start with the general problems and see how far we can get in our first segment of today's episode. I've identified, and I'll share with you today, four general problems with the pagan myth theory. The first of which is that the Gospels are not of the mythical genre. And I'll give two reasons. There are many reasons why we shouldn't think that the Gospels are of a mythical genre, but I'll just share two here today. The first is that the Gospel writers recorded details that we know are part of history and subject to historical verification. So, for example, they include actual historical events: the Passover, the Festival of Tabernacles, just to name a couple. They include historical individuals that have high-ranking positions, thereby making these individuals subject to verification. Details that are not the subject matter of the genre of myth, right? So, for example, Pontius Pilate, Joseph Caiaphas, the high priest, John the Baptist, Jesus himself, Caesar Augustus, Herod, Felix, Archelaus, Agrippa, Gallio, Caiaphas, Ananias. I mean, these are all historical individuals, and not just some random Joe Blow in the street, but individuals who are possessing popular and high-ranking status that would make them subject to verification. Again, not the texture or the nature of the genre of myth. And the gospel writers also identify the events of Jesus's life with historical time periods. So you have the reign of Tiberius, for example. This is not the stuff of mythology. So again, legends or myths usually aren't concerned with these kinds of historical details. But yet the gospel writers were concerned with these kinds of historical details. Therefore, we can reasonably conclude that the gospels are not of the mythical genre. They're historical in nature. Now, a second reason why we can reasonably conclude that the gospels are not of the mythical genre, and thereby giving us a general reason to reject the pagan myth theory, is that the gospel writers express their intention to write reliable history. And Luke is the prime example of this. In his prologue to his gospel, in Luke chapter 1, verses 1 through 4, here's what he writes. "Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things which have been accomplished among us, just as they were delivered to us by those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word, it seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely for some time past, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may know the truth concerning the things of which you have been informed." Now, in this prologue, there are three clues that suggest or reveal Luke's historical intent. The first clue is Luke's usage of the Greek word degezin, the Greek word for narrative. Greco-Roman authors used this word to specify the writing of history. The second clue is Luke's emphasis on eyewitnesses. Luke knows that by basing his narrative on eyewitness accounts, he makes it possible for his readers to corroborate his testimony about Jesus. He's trying to establish his own credibility as an author and a writer and a communicator of the events he's trying to communicate. And finally, the third clue, Luke identifies the purpose of his gospel as to give the truth about what has been taught. And Luke uses the Greek word asphalein, which is a word he uses elsewhere in Acts 21:34 that's translated as the facts. He's trying to give the facts. And so those are three clues that suggest Luke's historical intent. Now think about this. Why would Luke use a word that means writing history, emphasize eyewitnesses, and identify his purpose in presenting the facts if he were trying to write mythology or folklore? I think a more reasonable conclusion is that Luke is giving a factual narrative and not a mythical one. And so given that he's given a factual narrative and not a mythical one, we have good reason to reject the pagan myth theory. Again, this is the first general problem with the pagan myth theory. The Gospels are not of the mythical genre. Now, a second general problem is that the objection disregards the evidence that supports the historical reliability of the gospel accounts of Jesus' resurrection. I mean, so think about it. You know, in order for the pagan myth theory to even get up off the ground, you have to presuppose that the gospel narratives concerning the resurrection of Jesus are not reliable. the only way the pagan myth theory can be plausible is if you first reject the historical reliability of the resurrection accounts. But that's unreasonable given the evidence of the historical reliability of the gospel accounts. I mean, just one example among many is the eyewitness and early testimony. Again, for the pagan dying and rising God motif to be a plausible explanation, a skeptic would have to undermine the historicity of the details in the resurrection narratives. And that, my friends, is a project that won't succeed in face of all of the evidence to the contrary. And I'll just direct your attention. And we looked at that historical evidence in previous episodes already when we were giving a defense or making a case for the resurrection of Jesus. We went through the historical lines of reasoning for the historical plausibility of those details surrounding the resurrection of Jesus. But I'll just direct your attention to three resources before we close with this first segment coming up on a hard break here. William Lane Craig's book, The Sun Rises, Gary Habermas, The Case for the Resurrection of Jesus, and Michael Lacona, The Resurrection of Jesus, A New Historiographical Approach. Those would be some great resources that you can check out to establish the evidence for the historicity of the gospel accounts of the resurrection of Jesus. And if you have that in place, well, then, of course, you have yet another reason to reject the pagan myth theory. And the first two general problems, the first of which was the Gospels are not of the mythical genre, and we gave a couple of reasons why we can think that. And then secondly, the objection just simply disregards the evidence that would support the historical credibility of the Gospel narratives about the resurrection of Jesus. And as I pointed out before the break, in previous episodes of The Catholic Reason, we looked at some of that historical evidence to establish the historical ground of the resurrection accounts in the Gospels. And we were pulling from a variety of different resources, three of which I mentioned before the break in the last segment: William Lane Craig's The Sun Rises, Gary Habermas's The Case for the Resurrection of Jesus, and Mike Lacona's The Resurrection of Jesus, A New Historiographical Approach. Now, a third general problem with the pagan myth theory is that the first Christians were Jews, and the evidence shows that they were strongly monotheistic and devoted to the Torah. They weren't prone to syncretism with pagan ideas of trying to mix and mash their Jewish theology with pagan mythology. They weren't prone to that. And there's a lot of evidence for this. So I'm going to share with you some highlighted points that I've derived from several resources. So one resource is an article entitled Galilee-Jerusalem Relations According to Josephus's Life in the journal New Testament Studies, Volume 33, in 1987 by Sean Frain. And in that article, Frain points out that Josephus, who's a main literary source for first century Judaism, depicts Palestinian Jews at the time of Jesus as faithful, that is to say in the first century, right, as faithful to their traditional monotheistic beliefs and practices. So given that Jews were faithful to their traditional monotheistic beliefs and practices, it's unreasonable to think that they would have been prone to syncretism in mix and mashing their beliefs with pagan ideas and adopting those pagan ideas. So the first Christians were Jews, and the Jews were faithful to their traditional monotheistic beliefs and practices. So it's unreasonable to think that the Christians, who were Jews, would be mixing their beliefs with pagan ideas. The same author, Sean Frain, in the article Galilee from Alexander the Great to Hadrian, 323 BCE to 135 CE, A Study of Second Temple Judaism, this is a chapter in the book, A Study of Second Temple Judaism, published in 1980 on pages 143 to 144, Frain points out that there are unearthed coins minted in Palestine in the first century And these coins tend to be free of visual representations, suggesting the Jews of this time were offended by quote-unquote graven images, and that would indicate that they were deeply committed to following the Torah. Another resource, Jonathan L. Reed, in the chapter Galilean Archaeology and the Historical Jesus in the book Jesus Now and Then, Images of Jesus in History and Christology, published in 2001. Reed points out several details that are relevant to our discussion here. First of all, no pagan temples are found in the archaeological sites in Palestine, even to this date. Pagan temples are completely absent, thereby indicating that the Jews of the first century were not prone to syncretism, not prone to getting mixed up with pagan ideas and beliefs and adopting pagan practices. Given that the first century Christians were Jews, it's unlikely that they would have been adopting pagan beliefs and ideas when mixing it in with the resurrection story of Jesus. Reed also points out that ceramic wares found in Galilee are carved from a distinctive soft chalk limestone, which met Jewish ritual purity laws. Yet another indication that the Jews of the first century were faithful Jews to Torah. And given that the first century Christians were Jews, unlikely they would have been adopting pagan beliefs, which contradicted the Jewish practice and beliefs. Another detail that Reed mentions is there's a noticeable number of affluent Galilean homes that contained mikwath, if I'm probably butchering the pronunciation of that word, M-I-Q-W-A-O-T-H, mikwath. These were ritual bathing pools. And that indicates that the Jews continued to honor the practice of ritualistic bathing. Reed also points out in his chapter in that book cited earlier, in contrast to most pagan sites, Galilean excavation sites reveal a consistent lack of pork bones, indicating that the Jews of that locale honored the Levitical prohibition of eating pork. And there's another resource that corroborates this detail pointed out by Reed. B. Hesse and P. Wapnisch, can pig remains be used for ethnic diagnosis in the ancient Near East? In the book, The Archaeology of Israel, Constructing the Past, Interpreting the Present, editor N. Silberman, editors, plural, N. Silberman and D. Small. And that was published in 1997. So those are some details that indicate first century Jews were not prone to syncretism. Given that first century Christians were Jews, it follows reasonably to conclude that the first century Christians would have not have been prone to be pulling from pagan beliefs and practices to construct this theory about Jesus or this story about Jesus rising from the dead. Another resource is by Lester L. Grab and the book Judaism from Cyrus to Hadrian. This is volume one of the Persian and Greek periods, published in 1992. And in there, it's pointed out that Roman emperors customarily excused Jews from civilian obligation of worshiping national deities and being involved in national pagan religious activities. And so that indicates first century Jews weren't prone to engaging in pagan practice and adopting their pagan beliefs. They were holding fast to their own distinct Jewish beliefs, and at times Roman emperors were giving them permission to do that and excusing them from pagan worship. Another point that's pointed out by Grab is throughout the Roman Empire, Jews refused to honor gods, shrines, and cults other than their own. That's on page 170 of Judaism from Cyrus to Hadrian. So yet more evidence that the Jews were not prone to syncretism. And one last resource that I'll draw your attention to, and that's by E.M. Meyer, The Challenge of Hellenism for Early Judaism and Christianity. And that's in the journal Biblical Archaeologist, Volume 55 of 1992. And Meyer points out there in that article, the burial sites in first century Palestine are generally distinctly Jewish. allowing for bones to be collected and placed in a box called an ossuary sometime after the interment. So the conclusion here is that it seems that whatever influences Hellenism may have had upon the surface appearance of Jewish culture in Palestine, it didn't in any noticeable manner affect their core religious convictions. The Jews of the first century held to their core religious convictions. The population as a whole remained Torah true in religious orientation. And given that the first century Christians were Jews, it is unlikely that those first century Christians would have been pulling from pagan myths, beliefs, and practices in order to construct this story of Jesus's resurrection. All right, so finally, a fourth general problem is that the Jesus story would not have met needs or expectations of the Jews at that time. The implication here being that myths normally meet a social need. But the argument here is that there was no social need or expectations of the Jews that this sort of myth of Jesus' resurrection could have met. And here's a list of some of those things given by Gregory Boyd and Paul Eddy in their book, Lord or Legend, Wrestling with the Jesus Dilemma. They go through a series of things that Jews would not have been expecting that the Jesus story, the story of Jesus' resurrection, is offering, right? And so there's a disconnect there between what this alleged myth of Jesus' story, the story of Jesus' resurrection, and what the Jews at the time would have been expecting. So Gregory Boyd and Paul Eddy in their book, Lord or Legend, Wrestling with the Jesus Dilemma, they give a list of several examples of this. So for example, Jews were generally expecting a Messiah who would be an inspiring human leader and would liberate the Jewish people from Roman rule. Here's what they state. Instead of this militant political Messiah, however, the Jesus story centers on a God-man who allows himself to be crucified by the very enemies he's supposed to overthrow. If it's not rooted in history, which is what the pagan myth theory suggests, what explains this surprising, even oxymoronic, by first century Jewish standards, new story about the Messiah? The point being is that the Jews were expecting some militant political Messiah, not the Messiah that the gospel writers portray Jesus to be, this crucified Messiah. And so this is yet another problem with the pagan myth theory. The Jesus story has elements that would not have met any Jewish expectations of the first century. They also point out the Jews were generally expecting a Messiah who would reinforce the religious establishment and keep Jewish traditions blamelessly. Here's what they write. Yet Jesus's main opponents were from among the religious establishment, for he didn't meticulously honor Jewish traditions. According to the Gospels, Jesus's entourage consisted of far more sinners, prostitutes, and tax collectors than it did people in good standing with the religious establishment. We might also note the unprecedented honor Jesus showed to women, including women of ill repute, throughout his ministry. If they are not rooted in history, if the Jesus story is not rooted in history, if the resurrection story is not rooted in history, Boyd and Eddy point out, what explains these unusual countercultural aspects of the Jesus story? Again, there are details of the Jesus story that do not meet the first century Jewish expectations or needs, thereby counting against this pagan myth theory. And finally, they point out, Jews weren't expecting anybody to rise before the end of time. And Anglican New Testament scholar N.T. Wright points this out often in his work as well. Boyd and Eddy write, if it's not rooted in history, that is the Jesus story, and in particular the story of the resurrection of Jesus, what explains this completely new concept that lies at the center of the Jesus story? That a Messiah would rise, that Jesus would rise from the dead, is not something that would meet the first century Jewish expectation or need. And so that gives us reason to conclude that the story of Jesus' resurrection is not some mythological story that the Christians are pulling from pagan myths, Why? Because myths are often constructed to meet the needs of the audience to whom the myth is given. But that is not the case with the Jesus story, and in particular, his resurrection. That's a part of that story. And so we have four general problems with the pagan myth theory that we've looked at so far in today's episode. The Gospels are not of the mythical genre. That's number one. Number two, the objection disregards the evidence that supports the historical reliability of the gospel accounts of Jesus' resurrection. Number three, the first Christians were Jews, and the evidence shows that Jews were strongly monotheistic and devoted to Torah, not prone to syncretism with pagan ideas. And fourthly, the Jesus story would not have met the needs or expectations of the Jews at that time. The implication being that myths are normally meant to meet social needs, but that is just not the case with the gospel narratives of the Jesus story and the resurrection of Jesus. So those are our first four problems categorized as general problems. Now, let's look at the more specific problems. And this leads us to problem number five here, okay? And that is the suggested parallels with the ancient Egyptian and Greek deities are bogus. So, for example, it's often said that the story of Jesus' resurrection parallels the Greek vegetation god of Attis. Well, after dying, the spirit of the Greek god Attis entered into a pine tree. That's hardly a resurrection. What about Horus, the Egyptian god Horus? He's said to have been stung by a scorpion and then revived by his mother Isis via the performance of magical spells given to her by the god Thoth. But it's actually disputed as to whether the mythology says Horus actually died. If he didn't die and only became ill, as some scholars suggest, well then obviously there's no parallel with Jesus' resurrection. But even if we say he did die, well then the death and raising of Horus would still be pretty darn different in every other detail from the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. There is no magical spells being performed by anybody, much less his mother, for Jesus to rise from the dead. What about the Egyptian god Osiris? The Egyptian god Osiris actually never rose from the dead either. He merely reigned as king of the underworld. And the Egyptologist Henry Frankfurt points this out in his book, Kingship and Gods. He writes, Osiris was not a dying god at all, but a dead god. He never returned among the living. So there is no parallel between Jesus and Osiris. What about the ancient Persian god adopted into Roman beliefs, Mithras? Some skeptics will say there's a parallel between Jesus' resurrection and Mithras. Well, a female Christian apologist by the name of Mary Jo Sharp points out in her contributed chapter in the book, Come, Let Us Reason, she responds to this objection, or the alleged parallel between Jesus and Mithras, in this way. Quote, Mithras was proclaimed as invincible because he never died, and because he was completely victorious in all his battles. These aspects, she goes on, made him an attractive god for soldiers of the Roman army who were his chief followers. Pockets of archaeological evidence from the outermost parts of the Roman Empire reinforce this assumption. And she concludes, Mithras lacks a death and therefore also lacks a resurrection. So if you ain't got a death, you ain't got no resurrection. And so given that there's no resurrection within Mithras' story, there is no parallel with Jesus' resurrection. Well, what about the Greek mythological figure who was lover of the goddess Aphrodite, and this Greek mythological figure being Adonis? Well, in one myth, there is no death. And so if there's no death, well, then there's no resurrection. And then in another myth of Adonis, there is death, but then there's no resurrection whatsoever. So rather, as scholars point out, Adonis undergoes bilocation, spending part of the year in the upper world and part in the lower world. And the authors Gregory Boyd and Paul Eddy, whom I referenced earlier, deal with this alleged parallel in their book, The Jesus Legend, A Case for the Historical Reliability of the Synoptic Jesus Tradition, on page 143, if you want to check that out. Well, what about the Greek god of medicine, Asclepius, is how many will pronounce that Greek goddess name. Here's what Gary Habermas writes in response to this alleged alleged parallel. In his article, Resurrection Claims in Non-Christian Religions, in the journal Religious Studies, volume 25, he says this, Asclepius was a physician who was said to have healed through the use of medicines and ointments. He was killed by Jupiter, Zeus, but revived again and placed either among the stars or among the gods. And so Habermas engages with this alleged parallel and concludes that the parallel is bogus. He is revived, not necessarily a resurrection, revived with medicines and ointments. That's hardly a parallel with the resurrection of Jesus, where there was a real death and he was not healed, but actually resurrected, and no physical instruments like medicines and ointments are being used. So again, the parallel is bogus. Now, there's another specific problem with the pagan myth theory, which would constitute here our seventh problem totally, and that is to say correlation doesn't mean causation. And I have a list here of things when we correlate and compare President Lincoln and Kennedy, and we see that there's a correlation in their lives. But just because there is correlation, that doesn't mean there is causation. And the list comes from an article entitled, or a chapter entitled, Challenging the Zeitgeist Movie in the book Come Let Us Reason by Mark Forman. So here's a list of correlations between Lincoln and Kennedy that Mark Forman presents in his chapter, Challenging the Zeitgeist Movie in the book Come Let Us Reason. Lincoln was elected to Congress in 1846. Kennedy was elected to Congress in 1946. Lincoln was elected president in 1860. Kennedy was elected president in 1960. The names Lincoln and Kennedy each have seven letters. Lincoln had a secretary named Kennedy. Kennedy had a secretary named Lincoln. Both married in their 30s, a 24-year-old socially prominent girl who could speak fluent French. Both presidents dealt with civil rights movements for African Americans. Both presidents were shot in the back of the head on a Friday before a major holiday while sitting next to their wives. Both their assassins were known by three names consisting of 15 letters: John Wilkes Booth, Lee Harvey Oswald. Oswald shot Kennedy from a warehouse and was captured in a theater. Booth shot Lincoln in a theater and was captured in a warehouse. Both assassins were shot and killed with a Colt revolver days after they assassinated the president and before they could be brought to trial. Both presidents were succeeded by vice presidents named Johnson from the South, born in 1808 and 1908, respectively. Should we conclude that the Kennedy story is borrowed off of and ripped off of the Lincoln story simply because of the correlations between the two? I don't think so. I don't think it's reasonable to conclude that. So again, correlation doesn't mean causation. Now, finally, the last specific problem with the pagan myth theory, and the last problem total, that is our eighth problem here totally, Christians had no need to borrow the concept of resurrection from paganism since they had it in Judaism. Recall, Martha reassures Jesus of her belief that her brother Lazarus will rise at the end of time, right? He will rise again in the resurrection at the last day. That's in John 11:24. And this is no surprise given that Jewish prophets foretold the bodily resurrection in Isaiah 26:19 and Daniel 12:2. And Martha's ancient Jewish ancestors believed it, according to 2 Maccabees chapter 7, verse 23. So it was a part of Jewish belief and theology that there would be a resurrection at the end of time. So if the Jews believed in the concept of resurrection, the Sadducees being an exception, according to Acts 23:8, just one example among many, then why would the Christians need to go outside their Jewish culture to borrow the concept of resurrection when such a concept was already a part of it? The appeal to an outside source would be unnecessary. Now, this, of course, gives rise to the next alternative theory. Well, maybe, perhaps, the Christians weren't ripping off of pagan myths and stories to create the story of Jesus' resurrection. Maybe they were just ripping off of the Jewish belief. And so this is the Jewish origins theory. And so how should we respond to this? Well, there are several problems with this theory, all of which have to do with major discrepancies between what the Christians believed about Jesus' resurrection and Jewish belief about resurrection. Discrepancies that make it unreasonable to think that the Christians would have been ripping off of the Jewish belief. In other words, the Christians are believing stuff about Jesus' resurrection and the resurrection of Christians, generally speaking, the resurrection of all, actually, generally speaking, that's so distinct and different from Jewish belief about resurrection that it is unlikely and implausible that Christians would have been ripping off of Jews. So here's one example. Consider the Christian belief versus the Jewish belief concerning the timing of the resurrection to eternal life. The Jewish belief entailed resurrection to eternal life at the end of time. I already referenced John 11:24. You can also check out Mark 9:9-11. So because of such a discrepancy here, it is unlikely that the Christians would have been ripping off of the Jewish belief, right? Jews are believing resurrection to eternal life at the end of time. But yet here, the Christians are believing that Jesus rose before the end of time. So here's how New Testament scholar Joachim Jeremias, or Jeremias, however you wish to pronounce that, writes. He writes this in one of his articles: Ancient Judaism didn't know of an anticipated resurrection. Ancient Judaism did not know of an anticipated resurrection as event in history. Nowhere does one find in the literature anything comparable to the resurrection of Jesus. Certainly, resurrections of the dead were known, but these always concerned resuscitations, the return to the earthly life. In no place in the late Judaic literature does it concern a resurrection to glory as an event of history. The bodily resurrection would only be something at the end of history. And so given that discrepancy, it is unlikely that the Christians would have been ripping off of Jewish belief. Here's another example. Consider that the Christian belief was a resurrection to eternal life in Jesus' story as an event in history before the end of time, right? Okay, so here's a summary of the argument. Let me just summarize it for you. I got a little syllogism, or actually not a syllogism, but an argument here. Premise one, if the story of Jesus' resurrection would have been influenced by Jewish belief concerning the resurrection, well, then Christians would have thought of Jesus rising at the end of time. Premise two, but the Christians don't think of Jesus rising merely at the end of time, and so therefore the story of Jesus' resurrection wasn't influenced by Jewish belief concerning the resurrection. So that's a nice little modus tollens, is what we call that in philosophy. So given the Jewish belief of resurrection at the end of time, Christian belief of Jesus' resurrection in time, in history, before the end of time, unlikely that the Christians would have been ripping off of Jewish belief. Okay, here's the next example. Consider the distinction between, or the difference between, Christian and Jewish belief concerning who rises. For the Jews, no individual rises before the end of time. Everyone rises at the final judgment. For Christians, Jesus rises to eternal life before the end of time. So here's a summary of the argument. Premise one, if the story of Jesus' resurrection would have been influenced by Jewish belief concerning the resurrection, well, then Christians wouldn't have thought that God raised an individual person to eternal life in the body before the end of time. Premise two, but the Christians did think that God raised an individual person to eternal life in the body before the end of time. That's Jesus. And so therefore, the story of Jesus' resurrection wasn't influenced by Jewish belief. Here's a third difference. Consider the Christian and Jewish belief concerning a resurrection of the Messiah. For Jews, no expectation that the Messiah would rise. For Christians, they believe their Messiah rose from the dead. And remember what we said earlier, that whenever myths are created, it's always offered to meet some social need or expectation? Why would the Christians make up a story of a rising Messiah when that's not something the Jews would have been expecting, right? So again, we can summarize the argument. If the story of Jesus' resurrection would have been influenced by Jewish belief concerning the resurrection, then the Christians wouldn't have thought Jesus was their Messiah, their risen Messiah. But Christians did think that Jesus was their risen Messiah, and so therefore, the story of Jesus' resurrection wasn't influenced by Jewish belief. A couple of more here. Consider Christian and Jewish belief concerning the nature of the resurrection. For the Jews, limited properties of the resurrected body. It's just simply a renewal of life being brought back to this life, kind of like Lazarus. But for Christians, it was belief in a transformed bodily existence, right? Remember John 20:19, Jesus walks through the locked doors. He's appearing, he's disappearing. It is given that Christian belief and that difference from Jewish belief about the nature of the resurrection, unlikely that Christians are ripping off of the Jews. And then finally, consider Christian and Jewish belief concerning the importance of the doctrine of the resurrection for the Jews, not central to Jewish belief, but for the Christians it was. And so in light of these differences between Jewish belief in the resurrection and Christian belief in the resurrection, which has its origin in Jesus' resurrection, it is unreasonable to think that the Christians would have been ripping off of Jewish belief concerning the resurrection. Well, my friends, that does it for this week's episode of The Catholic Reason. The Catholic claim is that Jesus' resurrection story is not a copycat story, whether from paganism or Judaism, and I think we made good on that claim, given some reasons why both alternative theories aren't reasonable to accept. Thanks for listening to The Catholic Reason, again, a production of St. Michael Catholic Radio based in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma. You can download the show through whichever podcast platform you use by subscribing to the Eastern Oklahoma Catholic Podcast. You can also access the archived episodes at carlobrusor.com under the audio tab. I invite you to join me again next week for The Catholic Reason as we continue looking at Catholic claims and the reasons behind them. Tell a friend. I'll talk to you then. God bless.